Hello everyone, and welcome to the File Room Podcast, a podcast about the X-Files.
That is also a desperate attempt to reconnect a friendship across the Atlantic.
I'm Edwin Davis.
And I'm Michaela Livingston Banks.
If you're new to the X-Files or watching it for the 10th time, watch along with us while we explore the dark corners of the American psyche.
Via a TV show from the 90s.
Hello, Michaela. How are you this week?
I am A-okay. I am enjoying the delights of trying to sell a house. As of last week...
I understand that's an easy and stress-free process.
Sure. Yeah, like it's been really straightforward. There's been zero ups and downs and all good.
No false starts.
Yeah. No, we've had some false starts, but it's all good. I'm going to cross my fingers and say next week when we talk, I will have sold a house. Other than that, really, that's been pretty much taking up my entire brain, other than work, which is fine, and a little bit of mild interacting with friends. But yeah, how about you? How's your week been?
Yeah, my week has been pretty good. It's been a little less stressful than yours, I would imagine. Just the usual background stress of work and things like that. I did watch The Crow for the first time, the 1994 Brandon Lee vehicle, The Crow, which I'd never seen, which I feel makes me an outlier for people of our generation, because that feels like it was a real cultural touchstone for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Particularly the crowd that I was hanging out with as like a teenager when it was at its cultural apex, which was lots of goths.
Yeah.
Because that's a favourite movie of goths, because of the soundtrack, because of the general aesthetics, because of the horrible mystique of Brandon Lee's death occurring on set and all that sort of stuff. But it was just something that I never, ever got around to watching. And I watched it, and it was a lot of fun. It's a very stylish movie, got a great soundtrack. I think Brandon Lee's performance is really good, and also made me think, oh, that's what Heath Ledger was doing in The Dark Knight, because it's very, very similar to what he would then go on to do as the Joker. And then that obviously creates an unfortunate, tragic parallel between those two roles. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. And then I was especially happy because I watched that on Tuesday, I think. And then on Wednesday, the trailer for the remake of The Crow, which people have been trying to make since 2008.
Oh, wow.
And which has constantly fallen apart and is now finally happening, came out. And I felt like I had just got in under the wire of suddenly being able to be informed about whether or not I felt that it captured the charm of the original, because I had actually managed to see it before the trailer debuted.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like it does.
Oh, but I was going to say, can you tell from a trailer?
Yeah, but they tend to focus more on the brooding element. And I think the thing that makes the original Crow quite charming is he's quite funny. Like he's having a lot of fun with all of the revenge and all the violence that he's doing.
Absolutely,
and the new one, it's all seems very kind of like dark and serious. And that's a valid take on The Crow. And I think also illustrative of the problem, which is that if you tried to do what Brandon Lee was doing in The Crow, people would say, oh, you're just copying Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
It's the Joker.
Because
that performance has kind of had a very long cultural wash. So I think they do probably have to do something different, whether or not it's like an interesting take is probably something we'll all have to judge when people go and see it in cinemas, if people go and see it in cinemas later this year. But no, I was good. I was happy to have like ticked that off list of like the handful of massively famous movies that I have never seen.
Well, I think I must have watched it when I was about 15 or 16 or something, but only because my boyfriend at the time insisted.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember a huge amount about it, and I can't say I'm super enthralled to go back and watch it again. And I might watch the remake if it ends up on a streaming service that I happen to have for free at some point in the future. Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? We'll wait and see what the trailer looks like and stuff like that. I can go look it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched last night. We watched this movie called Bliss on Prime, which was quite interesting. It's Clive Owen and Salma Hayek, and obviously it's on the face of it this kind of like sci-fi thing, but obviously it's actually about addiction and stuff like that. And it's probably one of the more interesting and poignant movies I've seen in quite a while, but I enjoyed it. I liked it. So I can recommend that one.
I like both of them. They're both very compelling actors.
Yeah. No, I mean, it worked. This kind of weird, unhinged, zany, but serious thing. I mean, it kept your brain going the whole while. I didn't think about how selling or buying the whole time I was watching it. So, you know, 5-star from me for that reason.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. But anyway, X-Files.
Yeah, what else is good? This episode of the X-Files, I thought it was pretty good. We'll get into that. So,
end of episode. There you go.
People have busy lives. I'm just trying to give them a podcast by concentrate.
TLDL. Too long, didn't listen.
So yeah, we're going to be talking this week about the episode Lazarus. I'll give us a quick synopsis. So we open with Scully and FBI agent Jack Willis at a bank where they are expecting two robbers, Warren Dupree and Lula Phillips, to pull a heist. Dupree comes in after pledging his love to Lula in the car. He shoots Jack and is in turn shot by Scully. At the hospital afterward, Jack dies, but Scully keeps telling the doctors to perform defibrillation on him, which appears to bring him back to life. Later that night, Jack wakes up and leaves the hospital, and we quickly realise that he is in fact Dupree, possessing Jack's dead body. Mulder and Scully try to determine what happened to Jack. She believes that he has suffered some sort of psychotic break, and he eventually settles on the idea of him being possessed by Dupree. Scully reveals that she and Jack used to date and that they share the same birthday, which is important for later. Meanwhile, Dupree slash Jack looks for Lula. To that end, he finds and kills Lula's brother, Tommy, after accusing him of selling them out to the FBI. When Mulder and Scully arrive at the scene of Tommy's death, Dupree shows up and is accepted back on the team to help solve the case, because everyone, of course, thinks that he is Jack. Mulder, suspicious of Dupree, goes to see him at the agency firing range and gives him a birthday card for Scully, which he later presents to her as proof that Dupree is not actually Jack, since he did not remember that they share a birthday. She's still skeptical, but is disturbed when Mulder mentions that the fingerprint they pulled from Tommy's apartment went missing, implying that Dupree must have destroyed it to cover his tracks. Dupree gets a tip saying Lula is hiding out at an apartment building and heads there with Scully. After a chase through the building's basement, Scully apprehends Lula, but she then is kidnapped by Dupree. Dupree and Lula hold Scully for ransom while Mulder and the other FBI agents try to determine where they are. Scully tells Dupree about some of the time she spent with Jack, seeming to prompt some fragments of his memories to leak through, but ultimately with little success. Dupree complains about wanting soda and having stomach pains, at which point Scully says that Jack was diabetic and that drinking so much soda has put Dupree on the verge of falling into diabetic coma. Dupree and Lula rob a pharmacy for insulin, but at the last minute Lula refuses to give it to a weakened Dupree, revealing that she was the one who had tipped them off to the FBI and that she had planned to run off with the money while letting Dupree take the fall. Lula makes one more call to Mulder saying that she wants $1 million for Scully. Although she called from Scully's cell phone, making it impossible to trace the call, the sound of an airplane taking off in the background is enough, with a little audio manipulation, to tell the FBI roughly where they are. As the FBI surround the house, Scully seems to get through to Dupree, who remembers some of Jack's memories. He appears to die from his diabetes, but when Lula leans down to mock him, he grabs her gun and kills her before finally succumbing to his condition. At the FBI offices afterwards, Scully wonders what story to tell, and Mulder encourages her to tell the official story, that Jack died as part of the raid to get Lula. When she asks what story she should tell herself, Mulder says she should believe whatever she wants to believe. So that's the episode in microcosm. I've already tipped my hand somewhat to how I feel about this episode. So, Michaela, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what you thought of Lazarus?
I mean, it's a sort of fun police procedural take on a Freaky Friday situation.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
And, I mean, I found it generally quite compelling because it was quite pacey and it kind of whips through things. I think it was really well acted as well. So it had me at that, and yet somehow I come out of it just being like, oh, okay. So I think this is a solid average episode, but I'm not like super excited about it. And I'm not entirely sure what's bringing it down for me. And I'm hoping our conversation will help me figure that out. But yeah, you liked it. Tell us a bit about what you liked about it.
Yeah, I do like it. I do think that it is a solid episode rather than like one that gets into the upper echelon of the sort of the great episodes or even the really good episodes. I think it is just a very, very solid, if every episode of The X-Files was like this, it would still be remembered as a very good show.
Yeah.
Like, even if it never hit the heights of a Beyond the Sea or an Ice or a Squeeze, if every episode was just this quality, you would think that was a really good sci-fi show that did really interesting things and had really compelling acting.
Yeah.
And I do agree that I think it doesn't necessarily have enough of an emotional element to it, because on the one hand, you know, you only get to know like the real Jack and the real Dupree in that opening scene, and then they both die and then they switch bodies. So it's hard, I think, to feel an emotional connection to either of them once the Freaky Friday happens, once Dupree's spirit is in Jack's body.
Yeah. So I thought the acting from Chris Allport was good. You know, there's definite intensity and everything to it. But like, as you say, because we don't really see all that much of Jack Willis and Dupree at the beginning, it's actually quite hard to tell whether the character changes throughout, whether it's always Dupree, like that kind of thing. And I think that lack of kind of emotional connection is probably does play quite a large role in not being 100% sucked into the episode and going along with it fully in that sense, because I guess we're meant to care about Jack because of his relationship with Scully, and like there's a little bit of back and forth, you know, not just between Scully and Jack in a couple of scenes, but then also between Scully and Mulder talking about their past relationship and everything like that, where you build up a bit of a picture, but it's not really enough to make you care all that much by the end, I guess, for Jack, that is. I felt sorry for Scully, and Mulder was being gormless yet again at the end. I'm just like, Does Mulder not really know how to deal with people very well? This seems to be a pattern that seems to be coming up quite a bit. Like, he doesn't really always respond in the most empathetic or appropriate way with Scully and others.
Yeah, he definitely seems to struggle with people, which is in keeping with his kind of genius.
Yes, yeah.
Intellectual mind element of him, but that's obviously a fairly standard character trope of someone who's so brilliant at understanding all these different things about the way the world works, and in his case, you know, the secret ways that the world works, but then not being able to deal with the people in them. So, yeah, he does seem a little bit clueless when it comes to consoling people who have just lost like someone who is very important to them in an odd way, as has happened to Scully twice in, you know, the course of three episodes.
I mean, but, she's clearing up Jack's desk, and Mulder's kind of nicely gone and fetched this watch, I guess that's nice. And she said,
what am I supposed to tell myself?
Good night.
It's not working. It stopped. At 6:47.
The exact time that Jack went into cardiac arrest at the hospital.
What does that mean?
It means whatever you want it to mean.
He just says goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, could have done a little more to console her there, but that's fine.
I do think as well the fact that we don't get to know Jack very much before he dies is also a problem, because the central ambiguity of the episode from Scully's perspective is meant to be, you know, she thinks obviously that Jack has suffered some sort of psychotic break and that he is still in there and he's not being possessed by Dupree, and we kind of get a sense that, okay, maybe some of Jack is still in there because the memories do start creeping up, but without much of a grounding as to who Jack is, we're told all these things retroactively by Scully. It's one of those things similar to Ghost in the Machine, where Mulder's old partner is like introduced just to get killed off. I think it has that problem where you think, okay, this would be more effective if this character had been in a few episodes beforehand and we had a sense of who they were. And this ties into something that came up in a lot of the reading about this episode, is that the original idea for this episode was that Mulder was meant to be the one who was shot and then nearly died and then gets possessed, and then presumably at the end of the episode they figure out some way to get his body back, but the producers or the studio told the writers that they felt that it would not be a good idea to have one of the agents directly experience a phenomena like this, because it would kind of like puncture the premise of the show a little too much. And while I can understand that, and I think there's also, into practical things of like, if Mulder runs around killing a bunch of people as Dupree does slash Jack does in this episode, that does raise a lot of complications.
Yeah.
You can't do that. Oh, I wasn't myself. Defense for all that sort of stuff. I think it does remove the emotional core that could have really elevated the episode, where if it was Mulder, and we're obviously very familiar with Mulder at this point, and we're seeing that he is not himself, then that adds a complexity to the episode that isn't really there when it's someone that we just meet for one scene, and then the episode has to really work hard to make us care by having Scully talk about her past relationship with Jack, and then when she's being held hostage, you're trying to appeal to him and talk about all of the good times they had together and things like that. It does feel a little bit as if the episode is straining really, really hard to make you care about Jack in a way that never quite comes together, I don't think.
Yeah. One thing I will say is that I might feel a bit cheated that we didn't get to see David Duchovny really like acting other characters as Mulder, if that makes sense. But we do, there, you know, season six does deliver what I think is one of the finest two-part episodes of The X-Files in all its entirety. And it's really silly, but I love it. But it is six seasons away. So we'll just have to hang on and look forward to it then. We'll just look forward to that. Again, feeling sorry for the people I ought not to. Like, I obviously did end up feeling sorry for Dupree in the end, because obviously he's been betrayed by his wife, and, you know, they have this, as was described, an operatic romance.
While the pleasure they derive from acts of violence is clearly sexual, it also speaks to what Warden Jackson called their operatic devotion to each other. It's a love affair I almost envy.
Which I think probably does fairly well encapsulate how intense and over the top this romance, at least from Dupree's side, is set up as being. He clearly is mad in love with this woman enough to bring himself back from the dead via someone else's body. So yeah, if there is any sort of caring emotionally for anyone, like, I did really feel bad for Dupree. Obviously felt bad for bloody Scully getting kidnapped and beaten up again. Like, I don't want to see Mulder get kidnapped and beat up, but like, it always seems to be Scully who's getting the brunt of these things. Like, again, Gillian Anderson did a good job with her performance and portraying care and being upset and, you know, concern for Jack and everything like that. So that was all good. But yeah, the overall package, I guess, leaves you a little cold. And one of the other things I was sort of thinking about, that whole Jack Willis Dupree character switching type thing, was that I get a sense that maybe at some point in the writing process for this, and this was a Ganza Gordon duo one again, I feel like maybe they had aimed for it to be quite ambiguous. And then at some point in the writing, they were like, no, 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 let's have a tattoo that magically appears and disappears. Mm. And also, you know, that impossible dual trace EKG and things like that. And because you don't really know Jack Willis's character or Dupree's character very well, and you can't tell if they are switching or one's taking over versus the other so much, it, you know, but you do know there's a tattoo there. So like there are a couple elements that are like, could keep you thinking and on your toes and thinking, oh, what's going on? But then they put the tattoo in the mix and it's just like, oh no, they're really suggesting that like Dupree is in this body, magical, whatever, and that's just what's happening.
Mm.
And that, I think maybe that killed it for me a little bit too. Maybe I've probably complained a little bit about the Gordon Ganza ambiguity, too much going on situations in the past, but maybe in this case, it might have made it that little more, it might have been a little sprinkling of interest, perhaps, just to elevate it a touch, maybe, if it had been done well.
Yeah, or if he was switching somewhat regularly between the two personalities, because pretty much apart from the scenes where he's talking to Scully and he starts having glimpses of the memory of their trip to Montauk, or wherever it is that they say that they went...
somewhere up north.
Yeah. Apart from that, it is pretty much just Dupree in control the whole time.
Yeah, it seems that way.
If there was some switching back between the two personalities from time to time, that, I think, would have been a little more fun and a little more engaging, you know, the question of who is in control at this point. Whereas instead, from the opening scene, or not quite the opening scene, but from the early scene where Jack wakes up in the hospital and he like steals an old man's clothes, and you see him grab a bit of rubber piping to try and strangle a nurse if she comes into the bathroom where he's hiding out. And then he looks at his face and he sees his reflection and he gets a flash of the memory of him shooting Jack. From that moment, you're like, okay, so this is Dupree that's got control of him. And then for the most part, Dupree is in control. And even at the end when he kills Lula, it is Dupree who does it. It's not like Jack suddenly reasserts. It's Dupree doing it because she betrayed him, and she's responsible for his death and everything.
No.
Listen. We still have her. We can get away with this.
I don't think so, baby. Not this time.
Jack, put the gun down.
You remember that? That I talked about.
No.
It's beautiful. There's nothing to be afraid of.
No!
It does feel as if that element of it is a little bit undercooked, and that there were more compelling ways to do it. Either make it like totally ambiguous, which probably would have been very difficult from a writing perspective to make it really hard to tell who is this person, or the easier but also I think more compelling thing of having him switch between the two personalities from scene to scene, because like there's no tension when they go to the apartment building, Dupree and Scully, and she says, oh, where's backup, and then he says, I don't know, I called them 10 minutes ago. We know he didn't call them. We know that Dupree is in control and that he is just funneling her into a trap. Yeah. Whereas if prior to that we had seen some scenes where it was going backwards and forwards, then we wouldn't know, is it genuinely that he didn't make the call, or is it just that they're being slow, you know? So, yeah, I do feel like there are definitely elements of the writing that could have been stronger and made it a little more compelling as an episode. But I think a lot of the other stuff around it, like the performances, are all really good. We already talked about Christopher Allport a little bit, but I do think he's really good in that scene where he is waking up and he's he's conveying the sense that a new soul has entered this mm-hmm. body. He is good at playing jittery, particularly when he's in Tommy's apartment and yeah. he's holding him at gunpoint and everything. And Tommy, of course, is seeing this complete stranger in his room. And I think Chris Allport does a really good job of selling the sense of this guy trying to come to terms with this new situation that he finds himself in, and yeah, trying to find the woman he loves, even though it's a different person now, different body. And I do think there's a lot of fun actors around the margins in this. I really liked Jackson Davis as Agent Bruskin, who is the FBI agent who Mulder kind of gets paired up with towards the back half of the episode while Scully is being held prisoner. I thought he's got one of the largest chin dimples I've ever seen. like, he looks like a Lazy Town character. I enjoyed his back and forth with Mulder, mainly because he's obviously very skeptical of mm-hmm. Mulder's whole X-Files thing, even when Mulder is kind of like trying to talk to him about the evidence that they found. He's like, you know, this isn't another one of your X-Files, is it? But then when Mulder has got the evidence of where roughly they're hiding out, you know, Bruskin is the one in the room who kind of like quiets everyone down and says,
"All right, people, settle down and grab a seat. Mulder says he's got something."
"What? An alien virus or new information on the Kennedy assassination?"
"Hey, Mulder's all right. Just pay attention. You might learn something from the man."
Because he clearly recognizes that Mulder, for all of his eccentricities, is a great investigator and someone who can kind of puzzle these things together. And I kind of like that dynamic a little bit. I thought he was a fun character who doesn't have a lot to do, but again, is a good performance. And it's one thing I like when the show does, where it kind of fills out the broader impression that people have of Mulder within the FBI, which is the sense that everyone's like, yeah, he's kind of kooky, but also we all kind of really have to respect how good he is at actually solving crimes.
Yeah, yeah, because he's the one who thinks to go do the audio version of a visual enhance with some buffing, turning knobs on some sort of soundboard to get the perfect sound of an airplane taking off.
"If I were you, I'd stop talking and start passing around the collection."
"Yep, yep. There's something there. Definitely something at the high end. Let me throw on an extra Z14 filter and isolate everything over half a decibel."
"If I were you, I'd stop talking and start passing around the collection."
"There, that engine sound.
Let's clean it up some more."
"If I were you, I'd stop talking and start passing around the
collection." "Is that a small plane?"
"Taken off by the sound of it. Give me a couple more minutes, we'll guesstimate the altitude within a couple hundred feet."
It did make me giggle a little. And I wonder if this is actually true. I didn't look this up, but can you actually tell if a plane is taking off and what altitude it's at just from its sound from a muffled telephone recording? I'd love it if you could. Like, that would be very impressive. But yes, anyway, Mulder's the one who figures it out, basically, and manages to find them in the end, so he's nae bad. He can stay.
Also, in terms of minor characters, I really liked the scientist, Dr. Varnes, that Mulder and Scully go and talk to, who starts talking about previous instances of people seeming to have be possessed by other spirits and things like that. And
"There was a pilot in my support group who died in a commuter plane crash, along with his three passengers. This was a few years ago. Now, he recalls floating up in a brilliant aura of light and then feeling an overwhelming need to return to his body. He was revived in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, the only survivor. It was soon after that the vision started. Visions of making love to his wife, but in ways and in places that weren't in his memory. Now, it turns out that one of the dead passengers on the plane was having an affair with his wife. The dead passenger's memory, his consciousness, had survived through the pilot.
What happened?
Well, the pilot became increasingly disoriented. Schizophrenic, his doctor claims. Until one day, he strangled his wife with an extension cord.
It's a nice story.
Mainly because he has the same quality as the expert they go and speak to in Fire, where he's really, really excited to talk about his job, but his job is investigating horrifying things. So he's talking very animatedly about this guy who like went insane and then killed several people. And then Mulder at the end just kind of goes, "That's a nice story." Just very quietly, which is a very funny joke. Probably the line from the episode that made me laugh the most.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's another one where there's a small supporting actor who does a lot with very, very little. And just physically, that guy's great. He looks like a giant version of Danny DeVito as the Penguin. Like, he's kind of like, very kind of like hunched up and very, very striking physical presence.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't quite as aroused as the arson specialist, but yeah. I do love like the scientist in the lab coat, sort of nondescript scientist that they use as a mechanism of like trying to bring in A, an explanation, and B, to bring in that sense of scientific credibility or something to the idea. Obviously, near-death experiences, like, everyone knows the tropes. The bright light, the feeling of euphoria, the kind of other stories that seem to be very common. And, you know, I find it all super fascinating because, obviously, not being religious myself, I just find it fascinating thinking about why would we have evolved to feel good when we die? Because that's essentially what happens, like, when people experience hypoxia and those kind of things, or, you know, near-death experience, the brain starved of oxygen, like, you feel real good. Pain goes away, you feel happy, you're not scared, yada, 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 don't go towards the light. But why would that evolve? That has no benefit whatsoever for a species in terms of its ability to procreate and whatever else. So I just find that really fascinating. And I also think it's really interesting that, you know, and Scully mentions it, how you can generate some of these experiences by, you know, stimulating certain parts of the brain with, you know, magnetic fields and things. And obviously people who take certain types of drugs can have similar experiences as well. So it's just this experience is available to all of us in our brain. It's there, and you can access it if you take acid or have a near-death experience, or just you know, try not to die. I think it's just
or both.
Why not? Go wild. But yes, also I like the scientists they bring in to bring the science element and make it all feel legit and credible. Speaking of which, my sister-in-law, hello Amy. She is a diabetes specialist nurse. So obviously, given that one of the key plot mechanisms in this episode and the reason why Jack ends up dying is that he's diabetic, and this becomes, I don't even know what the right term is, but it's something that's kind of putting a bit of a deadline on the action that's happening in the episode, because he needs to have insulin. And so I was like, oh, hey, Amy, can you be my scientific consult for this? Like, does this seem realistic at all? And obviously she was like, well, you know, it depends what kind of diabetes he has and to what extent, yada, yada, yada. And she had a number of issues with the bit where he removes his intubation tube and stuff. She was just like, it's not long enough. It wasn't dramatic enough. Various other things like that. But she was saying that he wouldn't have died as instantly as he did, because the whole thing is you go into a diabetic coma.
Yeah.
So he would have been in a coma, but he wouldn't have just died like that. Except that she posits, and I'm inclined to agree, that if the idea is that he was only kept alive through Dupre's spirit or soul or whatever inhabiting his body, then maybe at the point where he's killed Lula and no longer has a reason to be because he only came back for her. So his spirit goes, Jack's body now dead. She reckons that. She was impressed, however, that the syringes were correct, because apparently syringes for insulin all have orange, they're like some special thing, they all have orange caps. But maybe another issue was with the length of time between him leaving hospital, where you'd think maybe he'd have had some insulin, and then when he starts getting, you know, the sweats and all of these things, which are symptoms of hyperglycemia, whichever one. So I don't know what that means in terms of the diabetes side. Maybe it's like a 50% mark.
Yeah, I was going, it sounds like a C-.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, they got some of the details right, but they're taking some liberties.
Yes.
Yeah, I think Amy's right about that. There's probably the spirit leaving at that moment that causes him to die, because the tattoo disappears off his arm as well. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that important spiritual part. I mean, that's kind of wild as well to consider as someone who has some tattoos. It's like, this is not just my corporeal form, but like my actual soul has been permanently marked with these things. So does that mean like I'm going to go to heaven with a fucking lemon on the side of my soul? I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I guess in terms of like various depictions of the afterlife, they're kind of inconsistent on that, really. And I'm not just talking about the X-Files here, but you know, in fiction in general, you know, you have the whole like Star Wars thing where Vader dies and then he comes back as like a normal looking guy, as opposed to the
scarred
version that he is. And then in the later reissues, they put Hayden Christensen in there. So like there's a sense of like, oh, I guess you could look like how you would want to look in life. So I guess. But then some, it's just like straight up, yeah, however you looked when you died, that's how you look in the afterlife. So, yeah. It'd be nice if it's, you get to pick. So then if you're tired of the lemon, you just be kind of like, we'll get rid of that one.
We'll get a cover-up or laser removal treatment. I don't know, maybe you could go even further, because like the Egyptians used to bury their dead with belongings and jewelry and other things that they thought they would need in the afterlife. Like you would physically take these items with you as you crossed over.
Yeah.
So if you could take an item with you into the afterlife, Ed, one item, what would it be?
Probably my guitar. Yeah. I think my acoustic guitar. I think probably be a fun one, just in terms of like what are things that, you know, just in a quiet moment do I enjoy just kind of like picking up and playing around with, like, yeah, probably the guitar, and then, you know, have all of the afterlife to try and learn more songs on it other than the 7 Pixies songs that I always seem to rotate between
Stairway to Heaven,
Metal Gear Solid 2. I do know how to play Stairway to Heaven, yeah, but I feel like that would be gauche.
Yes.
If you're paying that
too obvious.
Yeah, they have no stairway signs in heaven, I'm sure. Much to the anger of every guitarist who's ever died. What about you? What would you take if you had to take one item to the afterlife?
Can I take John? No, that's mean. He should probably continue to live his life. Yeah, I enjoy music, and that would be a good thing. Some random musical instrument to get better at, but actually I'm gonna take my Teddy Cutums.
Ah,
I've had him literally since I was born.
I was tempted to say my stuffed rabbit Raggett, who I have also had since I was born, and who is sitting on a shelf over there.
Wouldn't keep you nearly as entertained unless you'd had a bit of a mental break. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess if you wanted to just have someone to talk to, and if you were alone in the afterlife, and then you could just have conversations with it. But you could just draw a face on a guitar as well, so.
Can I change mine to a smartphone? So long as there's like 5G or something, I'll be good.
They've got 6G there.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow, yeah. Wow, wow.
Actually, no, hell would have 6G, 7 would have Heaven would have 7G. So if you look at your phone, it's a 6G, you're in trouble. Yeah, I think obviously the practicalities of the tattoo appearing are obviously kind of like fun to joke about, but I do think it's a very striking image that they come up with, the idea that that there's a like a physical signifier that he's taking over the body. And I think as well, like if they were doing a thing where it was swapping backwards and forwards, that would have been a cool signifier for the audience, if we noticed it. Obviously it'd be a pain for the for the makeup department.
Though I don't know it. I mean, as far as tattoos go, I mean, I'm no expert.
It's but a fairly
it
did, simple one. Yeah.
It's not even fairly simple as much as it almost looks a bit like a child drew it on with a biro. Mm-hmm. It's like this weird worm dragon image.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing they didn't have much time. Like they must, rather than like doing a transfer, presumably they didn't have much time and they just had to do some sort of simple image that they could. Mm. Although he says he was born in the year of the rat. Is that what he says? Is it a rat? And I'm just misseeing it. Like rather than the dragon or something. I don't know. Because it's kind of, yeah.
No, it was definitely more dragon-y than, he does mention being born in the year of the rat.
Yeah,
I think it's just one of those. He's just a very basic guy, and he thinks dragons are cool. Can I have a dragon tattoo?
Dragons are cool, but they're usually much more like coiled and dynamic than that. It's just the fact that it was just like a long worm, which it just looked a bit. Anyway, we're not here. This is not Ink Master. We're not here to judge tattoos, but yeah, in principle, as a kind of visual indicator of what was going on, maybe to make up for the fact that they knew that we're a viewer, we weren't really going to get to know either of the characters beforehand, so it like needed something like that. But I was going to say that actually that scene in the hospital where we're seeing Jack Willis, but it's Dupree, and he's seeing himself in the mirror, like that kind of like shock that he experiences, and then he's reliving seeing him shooting Jack, who he's seeing in the mirror. Like, I really like that. It felt a bit blunt, but effectively done nevertheless. And so whether or not we needed the poor tattoo or not, don't know, but it was definitely feel like it made it much more, this is some sort of paranormal thing that's going on, as opposed to the other possibility and Scully's thought of he's having a psychotic break, which also would have been very interesting to unwrap and unravel. But nevertheless, this is the X-Files. So I think they probably had to do something to anchor it more into the paranormal, which that the tattoo basically alone achieved.
Yeah. And it also, the last thing on the tattoo, it reminded me of, have you ever seen the movie Annihilation?
With the aliens visiting and the weird colors.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, how the crew who go into that area that's kind of under alien control, the idea is that their kind of like personalities and their kind of physical bodies start to lose their distinctness as they go. And one of the ways they indicate that is that they start having the same tattoo that Gina Rodriguez's character appears on all of their arms, which I thought was very neat in that film. And also I think that's what this reminded me of here as well. Kind of made me wonder if maybe that was an influence on that film. Because I don't remember if that's called out in the book, which is also very good. The Book of Annihilation is good. But it's obviously a very easy signifier to say that something strange is happening, that multiple people are sharing the same tattoo all of a sudden. And then another visual thing I thought was really cool was when Jack is being defibrillated at the start of the episode, one of the first things they do to indicate that there is some connection between him and Dupree is that you see Dupree's body in the background, or not in the background so much, they cut to it every so often. It also kind of like jerks every time he gets defibrillated, which is like, again, just a very cool, simple visual that gets across a fairly complicated idea very, very quickly. And I was very impressed with that, even though the whole time I was thinking, like, Scully, it seems really unethical that you're just telling these doctors to keep shocking this body over and over.
Don't does that count as abuse that you're just like hammering on at someone even though they're probably dead? I don't know, maybe this is something I should have asked Amy, whether or not they have kind of guidelines about that kind of stuff when someone's coding or is flatlining. How long can you, should you? I'll ask her that later.
Yeah, at a certain point you are just beating up a corpse. So
yeah,
like, yeah, I'm pretty, there must be a certain point in which they have to say, hey, we have to give up and this person is dead. And the other, I wouldn't say it's a nice thing because obviously it's quite gross, but the fact that Dupree, once he, the other thing that kind of like Dupree does after he wakes up and after he realizes that he's Jack, in Jack's body, is he goes to the morgue to see his own body.
Yeah.
Which,
would you?
On its own is like quite a nice like touch in terms of like him realizing what's happened. But then obviously because the corpse is wearing the wedding ring that he has said he'll never take off, he then goes grabs some surgical scissors and chops the three fingers off so that he can get the ring back, which is just a gross...
Yeah.
Obviously, the episode is not explicit about that sort of stuff. But just thinking about it, it's just quite gross.
It's just there's a noise, isn't there? It's like focused on Willis / Dupree's face. Mm-hmm. And you just hear this like crunch. And like, I think I find kind of bone breaking and things like that far... it really grosses me out like far more than like blood and guts and things. So yeah. I was just like, ugh. But he did say to Lula, like, I promised, I swore that I would never take this ring off this finger. But he did. He cut his finger to take the ring off. So he broke his oath.
Yeah.
No wonder she betrayed him.
Yeah, she was right. We're revisionist history now. We're saying that Lula was right.
Yes, exactly.
We actually haven't mentioned Lula very much, but I just want to say that I thought that Cease Ferrell, C-E-C, I assume you pronounce it Cease. I thought
or
she was quite good.
Maybe.
I thought she was quite good as Lula. She particularly, I think she's best in like the middle part of the episode once she's been reunited with Dupree and she kind of has to play the part of having to be persuaded that this is all what's really happening, because obviously it is a ridiculous thing for someone who you've never met to show up and say, oh, actually, I am your dead husband and possessing in a new body.
Your face is all dirty.
Keep your stinking hands off me.
Baby, you ain't gonna believe where I've been.
I think she does a really good job of making that feel credible, that she would be persuaded that this is true, even though it's obviously a ridiculous thing. And I think also she is quite fun when she makes her like heel turn at the end where you realize she was the one who betrayed them and everything. Oh, she gets to play a character at that point who is pretty much irredeemable, I think, in the eyes of the audience. And she seems to really delight in that. And I also think she does good work when Dupree pulls a gun on her or steals her gun and is about to shoot her. And then she's kind of like pleading for her life and trying to persuade him to let her live. She is another case of someone in this episode who gives a really good performance that I think grounds and also elevates, as contradictory as that says, as that sounds. But yeah, like makes it feel real, but also kind of takes the writing that is not as strong as maybe as it could have been and makes it a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure. I really also enjoyed how like her performance is really great, but also that scene where Dupree in Jack's body is like, it's me, baby, and she's like, what, get off of me, and I'm just like, no, it's me, baby, and just the look on Scully's face. It's just like, what the actual fuck? Love that.
Yeah, the episode it becomes a weird love triangle for a bit in the middle where obviously like, particularly from Scully's perspective, where it's like, so it's the guy that I used to go out with and broke up with who is maybe possessed by another person and is in love with this other woman. And yeah, it's very complicated. It's a lot to deal with.
Think that Scully broke up with Willis?
Well, I got the sense that...
She talks about him being really intense and things. So, like, clearly, like, you know, she's not got super rose tinted glasses, but that doesn't, like, we don't know, but they're on good terms, clearly, like they're working together for some reason at the beginning.
Yeah, broke up is probably, maybe it's too harsh, maybe it's just the sense that they both realized it couldn't work out. Yeah, it, maybe it's not, and it's not acrimonious breakup, but I do think it maybe it may have come more from her side based on what she says, in the sense that it kind of feels like he was too focused on his work and too intense maybe for her to deal with.
Very similar to Mulder. Like, maybe this is indicating that she's not into Mulder types. Just saying. But maybe they had to break up because they were in some sort of inappropriate relationship, because they do mention that he was one of her instructors at the academy. And I don't, like, it's, I think it's different in different universities and things like that, but it's generally frowned upon to date your students. Like, and I think in companies and stuff, like, different companies have different policies on this, but it's just like, could he not have just been another agent? I don't know. It's just a bit of an awkwardly inappropriate relationship, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that he was her instructor and then they dated after she graduated, but also then the problem was, like, well, Scully's still, like, quite young, obviously. Yes. Like, Gillian Anderson was only sort of in her mid to late 20s, so, like, there wasn't, like, a huge window for them to have dated between her graduating from the academy and the start of the series.
Well, they went out for a year. We know at some point they had a birthday and he turned 35. I'm assuming she gave him that watch whilst they were going out. And I believe at this point Scully is meant to be like 29 or something, like in her late 20s, maybe younger than 29, but sort of late 20s. So, and then depending how long ago she was in, she could have been in her like mid 20s and he was in his mid 30s. And I suppose once you're an adult, like, the age difference is not that big a deal. It's more about the relationship between, like, teacher and student, really. It's a bit weird, but
It's definitely more the professional context rather than the age that is kind of makes it weird, that you just kind of, like you say, if he was her instructor, that does seem to be a conflict of interest in a relationship.
You'd have thought.
Yeah. I don't know how it works at the FBI. Maybe they don't care.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe they should. in the made up FBI, I'm sure the real world FBI has policies on such things, but in the made up world of the FBI from the Ganza Gordon heads and everyone else, like,
last thing that I have written down, actually two things. I thought that I recognized Christopher Allport from other things, but when I looked at his credits, like, he had been in some stuff I'd seen, but, like, I didn't remember him from them. I just thought he looked familiar because he looks a lot like the actor Garrett Dillahunt from Deadwood, amongst other things. Yeah. Who's like a character actor who's in a million things and has a very similar kind of quality to him. And then I do really like, we talked a little earlier about Mulder as a kind of a good investigator, and how the trick he pulls on Dupree with the birthday card, I think, is really, it's a nice little detail and a nice case of him using detective work to try and gather evidence in a way that doesn't seem like he's gathering evidence to Dupree, because he's just like, yeah, you know, it's Scully's birthday, and knowing that if it's someone else in that body, they wouldn't remember that, or they wouldn't know, rather, that Jack and Scully share a birthday. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was a real good bit of sort of detective storytelling.
There you go. Happy birthday, Scully.
You're 2 months early.
It's from Willis. I thought you two had the same birthday.
We do.
Well, that's news to him. I asked him to sign it, and he signed it with his left hand.
You mean you tested him?
Yeah, after I found out that the evidence from the Phillips murder is missing.
Yeah. They could have shown better visually, I thought, the signatures being different, because they're quite similar. I even, like, rewound and had a look again, and I was like, okay, they are different, but not, like, whoa, in your face different, that me is a stupid brainless viewer found easy to spot at the, you know, at first watch, or second watch for that matter.
Yeah, it definitely felt like... Because I sometimes feel very self-conscious with that, because I always worry that my signature is like not consistent every time, and that eventually like I'll be signing some official document and they'll decide that I'm an imposter or something, because I'm just I'm not great at doing a consistent signature. So seeing that as like definitive proof, I was like, this doesn't look that bad.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's just the, and as well, you don't put your signature in a card. You sign your name. Like,
yeah.
My signature are my initials. It's not my name. I wouldn't sign my initials in a card to you. Not that I would ever send a birthday card to you, because I don't really do cards for birthdays, because I'm a mean friend like that. But yeah, you wouldn't put your signature in a card, I don't think. Anyway, that's a minor point, really. I did like how David Nutter, as director of this, he said something about wanting to keep the pacing quite fast to gloss over loopholes. And I don't think these things are necessarily loopholes, because actually, as the episode goes, I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as some other episodes where you're like, wait a minute. It's just in that case, it's literally just the visual difference could have been greater is all. But it was a pacey episode, and that was quite good. Also, in terms of building kind of tension and things, I thought Mark Snow's soundtrack was really good, because throughout there was this like heartbeat and kind of syncopated percussion thing. Syncopated is probably not the correct term, but anyway. There was like this percussive heartbeat thing that was going on that like really built tension. I did feel like maybe he misused the kind of horror strings, you know?
Yeah, we talked about the pizzicato strings.
The pizzicato strings, yeah. So we talked about them in Tombs, and it's been used a bit in a couple other episodes, but they used it in this episode. And sometimes it was like, oh yeah, this is something weird and creepy. Like I think with the tattoo it comes up. But they were also doing it as the FBI were setting up their sting. They were getting ready outside the house. And it was like, okay, that didn't seem like an appropriate use. You're like in this moment, and then I kind of felt like I was taken out of it. But otherwise, I thought the soundtrack was really effective in terms of keeping pace and also tension. So that was good.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that the music was really great. And I also felt that it was weird that they brought in the pizzicato strings again, because I always associate them with like the real nasty monsters of the X-Files, and it does seem weird that they bring in for essentially a guy, obviously a guy who's been possessed or whatever, you know, a spirit in another body, but it does feel like they went for the nuclear option on the soundtrack there when they didn't really need to. I also think you mentioned David Nutter, obviously, who directed this episode and directed a bunch of other really good ones. I think we most recently talked about his work on Beyond the Sea. He, I think, does a great job, not only just keeping the pace up, but also the episode looks really great in a lot of the sequences, like the sequence where they're chasing after Lula through the basement of the hotel. It's making really great use of shadows. There's lots of red light everywhere. It looks really, really evocative and creepy, and does make that sequence even more suspenseful than it was already, because obviously you're chasing someone through a dank basement of an apartment building is going to be quite creepy to begin with. So I thought he did a great job of using the visuals to amplify the sense of unease and terror during those sequences.
Yeah, they've been forming the kind of tone and visual style of the X-Files over the series and everything. And I think when they are working in the dark and with shadows, it looks really great. And I think if you said to people, what's the visual style of the X-Files, they'd probably, I mean, I would certainly think it's kind of that torchlight cutting through kind of a misty, dark situation. That seems like the iconic view of the X-Files with the torchlights. So do you think they're kind of purposefully looking for ways to bring that in to the story? Yeah. Like, oh, they need to go somewhere dark.
Yeah, definitely. I think they are, in writing the episodes, they are trying to think of like what is a claustrophobic place. Like we talked about this in Genderbender as well, with the like the layer, the organic goopy layer that they have to go and visit. Like, they are probably, when they're writing it, trying to think of what are locations that we can send them to that are going to be, like, really enclosed, that will create a sense of claustrophobia, yeah, or that'll be really dark so that, yeah, we can spook people. I definitely think it starts to factor into their thinking. Certainly around episodes like this, mm-hmm, that are more kind of thrillery, or the ones that go more into horror, I think obviously they use a somewhat different language when they're doing sort of the light and the more comedic episodes, mm-hmm, which, yeah, we haven't really had too many of so far, but certainly as the series goes on, they tend to do more lighthearted, funny episodes, which tend to change up the humour of it, because it's hard to laugh if everything looks scary.
True.
What would you rate this episode, Michaela?
I think I am going to give it a 6, possibly a 6.5. Kind of hovering in that, okay, kind of region. How about you?
I think 7 feels good to me. Like we were saying at the start, like, I think that it's one of those episodes where not everything meshes together, but it's still pretty fun.
Yeah.
And I think any time that an episode, you end an episode and you think, that was a good time, that's enough to kind of put it to slightly above average for me, versus some episodes that you watch, you know, like we've already talked about a few of them, but something like Jersey Devil, as a point of comparison, you know, that's an episode that kind of is similarly self-contained, but it really feels like much less in that episode works than in this one. So I do feel like this one, enough of it works. Yeah, yeah, this is a solid 7.
Yeah. I'm just thinking now, I'm losing track of what I've like rated. I'm going to have to keep a spreadsheet. Because, you know, the ratings need to be consistent. This can't just be because I'm like in a slightly less than positive mood because of stupid house market stuff. Maybe that is it. But no, yeah, I think I can get on board with that assessment.
Thanks everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, recommend us to your friends. It's the best way to help us grow all of this. You can also find us on Twitter, where we're at TheFireRoomPod, and you can email us at TheFireRoomPod@gmail.com. If you have any stories about having to move to an apartment very quickly, as multiple people do in this episode, I don't know.
Or having been taken over by a criminal, yeah, spirit, perhaps.
Yeah, near-death experiences, yeah, that sort of thing. Send them our way. Our music is by Lionel Cassio. We'll be back next time to talk about the episode Young at Heart, which I think is another okay one, another fun one. But welcome, obviously. It has been a while since I've watched it. But until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's bye from me.
It is real.